The political world is becoming increasingly volatile and unpredictable, while at the same time having a profound impact on the lives of citizens across the globe. This is Polis Podcast, and I am Thomas Barton, the founder of Polis Analysis. Every week, I'll be in the virtual armchair with relevant experts from Polis teams to discuss the key developments shaping the political world. All we need is for you to join us on the virtual sofa.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Polis Podcast. I'm joined by Fergus. Fergus is our Latin America analyst at Polis, and we'll be looking at Central American politics and looking at the sort of development towards more authoritarian practices in a lot of these countries. So last time Fergus and I were on this podcast, we talked a lot about South American states and their broader implications for our listeners in terms of the politics in that part of the world. So we're coming to a slightly different part of Latin America, which should be really interesting. So Fergus, do you want to just give a bit of background for our listeners who probably aren't very familiar with Central American politics in terms of what's going on?
Well, thank you for having me back. So we're going to be talking about the Northern Triangle, which is a region sits just below Mexico and is El Salvador, Honduras and Guatemala. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about Nicaragua, which is the country just below, just because it fits quite well into the political situation in the region.
Sure.
So at the moment, this area has been described as Biden's other headache by many analysts and newspapers. I mean, in reference to Afghanistan and also the migration northwards, especially from this region. Democracy appears to be facing severe challenges in the region as these authoritarian governments led by strong men such as, well, in El Salvador, we have Nayib Bukele, he's described as like the millennial dictator by some. On the 4th of September, his proposal to change the electoral system was accepted by the Legislative Assembly. That is actually dominated by his party. I mean, Nayib Bukele has an 87% approval rating in his country. And he's using this popularity to really further his own goals, or supposedly further his own goals.
Is that a genuine approval rating, or is that sort of a classic sort of, you know, out of a playbook of a dictator in terms of...
he's saying it or is the country saying it? He is known to be one of the most popular presidents in Latin America. And it's largely due to, because he's very different to what's come before. So I'll speak a little bit about the history of the area. It's been dominated for a long time by oligarchs. A lot of small families. So actually in El Salvador, they used to have something which was known as the 14 families. He basically dominated the region. And we also had Somoza, Augusto Somoza, in the neighboring countries, in the country of Nicaragua, before the Sandinista Revolution, which is actually where Daniel Ortega, who is the president nowadays, he was a Sandinista. And they were democratically ousted in 1990, the Sandinistas. But he's becoming much more authoritarian. He actually recently, he imprisoned his 13 closest rivals for the election later this year. So it really does beg the question of what does America think about, the US think about this happening, and what they used to refer as their back garden, I put that in inverted commas. And they have a huge history of military intervention in these areas. I mean, it started from a company that was called the United Fruit Company. And these countries were known as the Banana Republics because the United Fruit Company had such a stronghold on this area. And I'd say that legacy has continued until today. And it's going to be interesting to see what Joe Biden, he's being pressurized heavily by the migration that's covered by every news across the world, on his border, on his southern border in Mexico. And, you know, Kamala Harris had a very high profile visit to Guatemala, where she actually said to Guatemalans, "Do not come," was her. And she got quite a lot of backlash in the US, especially by Anastasia Cortez, who referenced the military intervention and how America is basically, she referenced how potentially they are to blame for some of the issues in Guatemala.
Right.
So it's a bit, she wasn't very happy, essentially, that Kamala Harris had gone to Guatemala and said, "Do not come to people they really should potentially be helping out."
Yeah, I mean, that's a very tough stance, and it's not necessarily what people would expect from a Democrat run administration in the United States. But what I'm trying to wonder, Fergus, you've obviously talked about the impact of immigration on the United States. And I believe, yeah, since 2014, about 2 million people have left the Golden Triangle to go to the US. So there's clearly some clear, you know, migratory flows that's probably going to pressure the US into making a decision. But I suppose, and this will sound harsh, but why does the political situation in these Central American countries really matter? Because ultimately, these are very small countries which don't have much economic weight, right? And as we've seen, I mean, the United States is sort of retrenching itself a bit from in its foreign policy and from taking, you know, where they could have taken action in the past overseas to meet their objectives, they're starting to scale back. Obviously, the Afghanistan crisis is the key sort of latest example of that. So I'm just wondering whether you think, you talk about Biden's second headache. I mean, does Biden want to give himself a migraine by intervening in this part of the world, which might not necessarily be the most important area? Or is that too, am I underselling?
No. I think there's definitely, people would definitely agree and wonder why perhaps the Northern Triangle is important. But it really is important on a global scale and also on the local scale. I'll talk about the local scale first. I mean, the corruption and the violence actually in these countries, which is leading so many people to immigrate, is directly affects should directly affect what people think, because of how bad it really is. I mean, Honduras, the rival to Juan Orlando Hernandez, who is the president of Honduras, said that the nation had nothing to celebrate on its bicentenary of independence this year, so 200 years since its independence. And he said this because of the poverty, the violence, the corruption. I mean, they have femicide is a massive thing in Honduras. This is basically people killing women because they're women.
That's such a loaded statement for someone to say that in the last 200 years of their history, there's not one thing for that country to celebrate. I mean, that's the definition of a failed state, is it not?
Yeah, it is. It is definitely. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think Honduras is, I mean, it's very rarely in the news because I think of how long this has gone on for, that people just have kind of slightly accepted the fact that Honduras really is a kind of a no-go zone, an area that there's not much to invest in. There's not much to. Whereas actually, I mean, it's very sad because in the past it was heavily invested in by the United Fruit Company.
Right.
But on a larger scale, people should be interested in this area because of the geopolitics behind the fact that China and Russia have slowly been moving their way in as the Americans have moved their way out. So in 2002, Chinese FDI in the region only totaled about, I think it was $17 billion. By 2019, it had reached $315 billion. This is the entire of Latin America, but they do focus very heavily in Central America. So there's actually Chinese businessmen who's recently bought an island off El Salvador in the Pacific, with the intention, well, supposed intention.
This is very Fergus, does that matter? Because, I mean, the El Salvador rating for foreign direct investment is trash, right?
Yes.
So does Chinese investment pose the same threat in El Salvador or Central America more widely than it does to Western interests, say, in African states, where the Chinese One Belt, One Road sort of infrastructure investment program is having a bigger impact?
True. I think it's the geography. I think of how close it is to America and the history that America, the US, does have in Central America. I mean, they recently, Biden has just announced that he's going to launch an aid campaign for the Northern Triangle. I mean, and this is in the billions of dollars, cooperating with Mexico to try and ensure that they are generating jobs for people to stay in. This is their proposal for people to stay in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala. Because
do you think that will be effective? I mean, Amnesty International said that, you know, there've been crimes against humanity in Nicaragua. So you can give economic support, but if you're being persecuted by your government, is that enough of a reason to stay? Is this the right strategy by the Biden administration?
That is the big thing. And also whether the aid money will actually trickle down, will actually be effective.
Exactly.
Will it actually, and in the past it hasn't been, I think there's evidence to show that. And the way that the Biden administration is responding to these authoritarian or supposedly authoritarian or leaning towards authoritarianism, the regimes, is interesting. They seem to be cozying up to these guys rather than potentially going the other way. And yes, you know, this aid campaign, the money will go straight to the governments. These aren't going to be companies going in and helping them, like NGOs. This is money going to the government, money going to Bukele, money going to Daniel Ortega, money going to Hernandez, instead of straight to the people. And I mean, I think Daniel Ortega, for example, has shown that he really can't be trusted in this way.
Well, I mean, he's a dictator, isn't he? I mean, if you look at the behavior that of his regime, it's highly authoritarian. I was looking at this recent arrest warrant that he issued for Sergio Ramirez, who actually I believe was his former vice president in the 80s as part of the Sandinista regime. And part of the reason for that arrest warrant is because of a book that Ramirez has written, and the book has been sort of banned. And copies are being seized by customs officers. I mean, this is just classic dictatorship behavior, is it not?
Yeah, journalists are fleeing the country for their lives. Free speech is in peril in Nicaragua and in Honduras as well. And, you know, some people think Bukele, the El Salvadorian president who actually came in 2020, has made Bitcoin a legal tender in the country.
Right.
And he's actually forced people to use it. He says that you have to. If someone wants to pay with Bitcoin, they are legally allowed to pay. And some people think that this is corruption in itself, because he's using the kind of volatility of the cryptocurrency to his own advantage, to further his own personal and his own personal gain and those close to him. I mean, he recently fired the Attorney General and six of the Supreme Court, and put in their place, he put people who were close to him.
And that sort of behavior doesn't necessarily put off powers such as Russia and China, because they've shown they're happy to intervene in these sort of countries and overlook those. Those behaviors. But I mean, you've talked about what the US's response is. What are Russia and China actually doing in the region?
So a lot of Well, it's FDI, but with, so as I was saying about that island, it's an intention of a deep sea port to try and further Chinese actual military potential in the region, give them a kind of a launch pad of sorts into the Central America. And there was talks about, you know, them creating their own Panama Canal through Nicaragua. That hasn't happened. And it fell through a few years ago. But, you know, Daniel Ortega is now, China's focusing very heavily on El Salvador. Russia's focusing more heavily on Nicaragua because of the Sandinista history. And so actually the Russians aided the Sandinistas and, or the USSR aided the Sandinistas financially and militarily in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Whilst the Americans were, it's a proxy war of sorts. And so Vladimir Putin and Daniel Ortega have a very close relationship. But as we've been talking about, they do it very cheaply. The Russians do it very cheaply. They're not putting general actual money into Nicaragua. They are just cozying up. Rather than the Chinese way, which is more focused on investing in things such as, I mean, even property, and this, I mean, this island is probably the greatest example.
I mean, I guess with Russia, yeah, foreign policy on the cheap is often the strategy they go for. They sort of find a situation which they can exploit, and then they feel the vacuum is often left by the absence of US and Western presence. But I suppose the real threat that the Biden administration will be concerned with is therefore not sort of, you know, political closing up by Putin to key figures in Nicaragua and other parts of Central mm-hmm. America, but they're probably more concerned, given their whole agenda in pushing back against China, that the Chinese state is investing heavily in the US's own backyard.
Exactly.
So do you think that will lead to US action? Will the China dimension be what it takes? If it's not the humanitarian suffering and the human rights abuses, will it be the, and if it's not the migratory flows, will it be the sort of heavy Chinese presence that will do it and force the US into taking action? In your view?
Yes, I think so. I don't know how much longer the US can leave it in terms, if they're speaking a geopolitical way, because, you know, they don't want to lose power in their own backyard. And these three strongmen that we've been talking about, Daniel Ortega and Nayib Bukele, and in Guatemala, Gio Matuidi, are all cozying up to their supposed enemies again, in inverted commas. And the fact that they are becoming more authoritarian means that they, you know, democracy is in peril, which means they have more time to solidify their bases with China and Russia. Bukele has just extended he's allowed himself to extend his term by 1 year and actually go for re-election again. So he, you know, we're looking at a guy who could potentially be in power for 10 years. Although this is an incredibly unpredictable region, it's something that is very much on the cards. And in terms of what the US will think about that is that they need to increase their popularity with these strongmen if they're going to be there for so long. It's something that they've done before.
Right.
In history, you know, they have supported right-wing kind of dictatorships before in Central America. So it just depends on how they go about it. And maybe this aid campaign is their first response. We've talked about it. I'm personally skeptical about whether it will succeed or not. But it's showing it shows signs that this is something that they are beginning to take note of. And right. I do think rather than it be the migratory flows or the human rights abuses, I do think it is the fact that their geopolitical enemies as such are in the region and are very much active.
Well, yeah, ultimately it's not coherent to talk tough on China and try and, you know, counter Chinese influence in Africa, because obviously Biden and other Western countries are now scrambling to provide an alternative to the Chinese investment in that continent. It's not coherent to try and counterbalance Chinese influence in one part of the world, only to allow it to extend in your own backyard. But I suppose, you know, Fergus, given your expertise in the region, I know we've talked about this offline as well, that it's extremely difficult to predict future political developments in Central America. At Polis, we always do try, though, to help our followers understand and anticipate what's coming up next. I mean, do you think it's fair to say that these Central American countries are going to continue to backslide into authoritarianism, or is there hope on the horizon that democracy could be restored to some parts of Central America?
I would say democracy is at the moment hanging on a cliff edge in the Northern Triangle, especially. I mean, Daniel Ortega, there's elections in November. He's arresting his opposition and forbidding the rival parties to actually take part in the election. So that to me is a dictatorship. I would say that is definitely Nicaragua, unfortunately, is sliding towards authoritarianism, and in fact it's not sliding, it's hurtling towards it, it seems.
Well, when you arrest all your political opponents in time for the November election, then you can't label that as healthy democratic practice.
International pressure has really not put him off either. Michel Bachelet called him a dictator. He's carried on in the same way. Michel Bachelet is the UN Human Rights Commissioner. And so, you know, Nicaragua, I would say, is off the table in terms of democracy. Honduras and Guatemala there's more positive things coming out of those two countries. We've seen the largest protest in 6 years in Guatemala just a month ago, calling for Alessandro Giammattei to step down. Whether he will heed these calls is something very different. It seems that he actually is giving the military more power than they've had since the military dictatorship, which ended in 1990 and ended with 200,000 people dead as well. And that is something that worries a lot of Guatemalans, understandably so. In Honduras, we were talking about how the rival party is gaining quite a lot of traction, actually. Whether that is foreign, this I've been looking at this through American eyes, whether this is something that is just in America rather than local is yet to be seen. However, the celebrations on the bicentenary were more a protest than a celebration, which is very interesting, because this is something that Hernandez had bigged up a lot, this 200 year celebration. So the fact that most people came out to protest rather than celebrate is a positive for those who want to see Honduras succeed. And then we have El Salvador. And I would say El Salvador is the trickiest to predict, because Nayib Bukele has been praised actually by some people for his use of Bitcoin. The tech industry potentially thinks it's a very interesting development. I think the whole world will agree it's a very interesting development to see how this really goes. And he's just launched a constitution which is looking for abortion in one of the, it's trying to put forward abortion, trying to put forward women's rights in a very actually heavily machistic society.
Which is the total opposite of the current director of travel in Guatemala, for instance. So yeah. I suppose it goes to show, and we talked about this but last time.
Hidden things behind this constitution.
Right.
Stuff like him extending his, he's using his popularity to extend his own personal gains. And, you know, people even in his party have been saying this. One of his his former vice president fled the country 2 months ago to the United States, and was reported saying, you know, that there are hidden agendas behind his constitutional reforms.
Okay, so we shouldn't necessarily take it at surface value.
Exactly. This is why people call him the millennial dictator, because he really can use social media to his advantage. He really can use these technological gains. He has a lot of. He went to university in the US. He speaks perfect English. He's a very intelligent bloke, but it's how he's using this intelligence that people want to know.
Well, a modern autocrat using the latest tools at his disposal, potentially. Look, Fergus, this was fascinating. I think it's brilliant that you've helped our listeners understand the political forces at play in a part of the world, Central America, that is not often covered in the headlines. And I think it's really fascinating also to realize that this is once again a battleground for wider geopolitical forces, notably this constant rivalry between the US on one side and Russia and China on the other, that is fast defining all major developments in international politics.
It really is.
So thank you so much for joining me. And I'll be joined next week by someone else from the Polis team. We'll actually be looking for our subscribers to make recommendations and suggestions on the sort of parts of the world, the developments that they want us to talk about. So please do contact us at hello@polisanalysis.com if you want the Polis podcast to address any particular development or part of the world that you're interested in. But thank you so much, Fergus, and thank you to our listeners for joining us.
Thank you for listening.
We hope you enjoyed this Polis podcast episode. At Polis Analysis, we are fully devoted to helping individuals better navigate the political world. So we would love to hear your thoughts, and please do share any suggestions you may have for future Polis podcast episodes. Follow the Polis podcast channel on Spotify to access our weekly episodes. And if you want to better navigate the political world with accessible, fact-based and impartial analysis of global politics, then sign up to our free newsletter at www.polisanalysis.com. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.